Today is Tuesday, the 27th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden says that the U.S. will change the focus of its forces in Iraq.
The outcome is that the U.S. is changing the name or changing the words it uses to describe its mission to combat the Islamic State terror group in Iraq.
Plus, election officials in Myanmar declare last year's election void. What does it mean for the country? And looking ahead at preventing additional pandemics. These stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden hosted Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadimi at the White House on Monday. The pair discussed the future of U.S. troops.
We're also committed to our security cooperation. Our shared fight against ISIS is critical for the stability of the region, and our counterterrorism cooperation will continue even as we shift to this new phase we're going to be talking about.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon has been following the story and joins us to kick things off. Jeff, what exactly did the president and the prime minister discuss?
Essentially, what the outcome is that the U.S. is changing the name or changing the words it uses to describe its mission to combat the Islamic State terror group in Iraq. For a long time, it's characterized its mission as a combat mission, even though the U.S. troops, 2,500 or so on the ground in Iraq, have been mostly involved in advising and assisting Iraqi forces as they pursue and go after ISIS. Now, what's happening is that the president on Monday, after meeting with the Iraqi prime minister, said it's no longer going to be called a combat mission. It's going to be an advisory mission, an assistance mission to Iraq with the Iraqi forces in the lead. The question is, how much does that really change? As we've heard a number of officials, including a representative of the Kurdistan regional government from Iraq, say for a long time, U.S. forces have not been going into combat. They've not been on the front lines like they once were. What they've been doing has been mostly behind the scenes, training, assistance, intelligence, and airstrikes. So the big question will be, how does that change going forward, if at all? The initial indications are, in terms of what we see going on in the ground, there isn't a lot going to change. It's going to be pretty much static for right now.
There have been some calls from lawmakers in the region to have the U.S. forces be withdrawn from Iraq. Given the bilateral talks that happened today, is there any indication as if those 2,500 troops are going to be drawn down?
There's a possibility that some troops could leave the region, and they could be either not replaced, or perhaps they could be replaced by other troops that are not combat troops, but might be better positioned with their training, their expertise, to actually just advise and assist the Iraqi forces as they continue their anti-Islamic State mission on the ground themselves. The other thing that complicates the U.S. footprint on the ground in Iraq is that it's linked to the U.S. footprint in the ground on Syria. There are supplies and other things that go from Iraq to the 900 or so U.S. troops on the ground in Syria as part of the counterterrorism mission that the U.S. has there, with assisting and advising mostly the Syrian Democratic Forces in northeastern Syria. So any move that's made in Iraq has a fallout effect on the troops on the ground in Syria. And we haven't really heard a lot about the U.S. being ready at this point to pull troops out of Syria, where the situation is more tenuous. Because while there have been gains made on the ground, and while the Iraqi security forces have been in some cases highly praised for the pressure they're putting on Islamic State, that type of consistent pressure does not exist in Syria.
I wanted to follow up on that bigger picture with the Islamic State militant group, because that has been some of the concern that if U.S. forces continue to withdraw from the region, the Islamic State group could revitalize itself and cause more problems, not only in the region, but throughout the world. So, you know, given that as a concern, you know, what kind of things are the world at large looking at in terms of the region as it pertains to ISIS?
Overall, big picture, beyond just Iraq and Syria, the main concern that is being voiced by the United States and its allies, and especially Western countries, is this growth, this birth of terrorism and expansion of terrorism in Africa, whether it's Al-Qaeda or Islamic State. And the two groups are rivals, but both have affiliates throughout the African continent. And in the words of some senior U.S. commanders, the spread of these groups has continued unabated despite efforts by the U.S., France, and some other countries to try to rein it in. So a lot of the focus on the U.S. counterterrorism mission is moving and is shifting to Africa, where you have Islamic State West Africa, which may be regaining momentum, where there are persistent concerns about Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, which, according to a recent UN report, now is using drones to surveil and perhaps preparing drones to launch attacks on commercial and humanitarian aviation in Kenya and Somalia. So there are a lot of concerns there. There are also concerns, though, in Iraq and Syria, the core areas for Islamic State where it first announced and tried to establish a short-lived caliphate, because the ISIS fighters there, while down to maybe 8,000 to 10,000 fighters, a far cry from what it had during its heyday, it's been resilient. It's been able to transition from a proto-state to an insurgency. And according to most intelligence agencies, it's ingrained, it's resilient. And the recent attacks it's been able to pull off, especially in Iraq, including some in Baghdad, have shown that it's really been able to go to establish itself in a way that it could be there for the long haul. And the bigger overriding concern for the U.S., because while in Iraq and Syria, Islamic State would not be a threat right now, according to most intel agencies, most counterterrorism analysts to the West, the ideology and that core ideology and the birthplace of that ideology is poised and perhaps even to expand and to get new adherents. And so it's a complicated picture, and there's a lot of thought being put into how best to counter it. The U.S. is moving back from wanting its own troops on the front lines of the kinetic fight on the ground, but there's a lot going on behind the scenes to try to make sure that its partner forces are able to keep ISIS and other terror groups in check.
Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent. Pakistan said Monday that dozens of Afghan border forces, including several officers, took refuge on the Pakistani side after being unable to hold their military posts, apparently in the wake of advances made by Taliban insurgents inside Afghanistan. From Islamabad, VOA's Ayaz Ghul shares the latest.
Yeah, this is quite an embarrassing situation for the Afghan security forces overall, because, you know, billions of dollars that have been spent on training these forces are obviously raising questions that why are they unable to hold on to their positions in the wake of these Taliban attacks. But that also shows that the kind of strategy that the Taliban has applied to overrun these areas has been that they have literally besieged certain areas or districts in Afghanistan for a long time, choking all the supplies to these military posts, major military posts. And this one obviously is located far away from, like, in the extreme northeast of the country, which borders Pakistan's Chitral town. So obviously, these soldiers that are, you know, 46 soldiers, including five officers, were surrounded, according to the reports, by Taliban, because that's on the border with Pakistan. So instead of putting up some kind of resistance or fight against the invading Taliban, they just contacted, what we understand from the Pakistani military statement is that their commander contacted the Pakistani side of, on the Pakistani side, the Pakistani military, and requested some kind of a safe passage or refuge. And that's when Pakistan military says that they allowed them to come into Pakistan, and then they have given them shelter, served them food, and, you know, they're going to repatriate them possibly tomorrow back to the Afghan government. And this is not the first time that this thing has happened. Earlier this month, 35 Afghan soldiers also crossed over into Pakistan.
Ayaz, I wanted to ask you about that Taliban drive to capture more territory. We have spoken before about the Taliban and how they are controlling various border crossings. with this latest news of Afghan soldiers crossing into Pakistan, what does this mean overall to the status of borders between Afghanistan and its neighbors?
Well, that is a very challenging situation facing the Afghan government because, you know, Afghanistan is a landlocked country and it heavily relies on all these border crossings for trade with neighboring countries and with regional countries. And now with all these border crossings controlled by the Taliban, you know, whatever revenue the Afghan government was generating is now in the hands of the Taliban. So that's quite a serious financial blow, the effects of which will be quite visible in the coming weeks. So when the provincial government and the central government will be, facing this crunch, financial crunch, at least the locally generated revenues, because we know that most of the funds that the Afghan government has come from, international assistance. But this internally generated revenue has been the hallmark of how the Afghan government was able to run the system despite this long war going on. But this is, unfortunately, this incident of Afghan soldiers coming into Pakistan is they're coming at a bad time because relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan have really plunged to new lows. Afghan officials have long accused Pakistan of sheltering Taliban leaders and allowing them to direct attacks inside Afghanistan. And now lately, when Taliban captured the Spin Buldak border crossing with Pakistan, that's a very major border crossing between the two countries. And so much revenue is being generated from that border crossing that Afghans are really unhappy and they have been condemning Pakistan. But then today this incident happens and Pakistan is using this incident to show off that Pakistan is in fact helping the Afghan government rather than protecting or helping the Taliban.
I ask one last question. The United Nations put out a report saying that civilian casualties are up some 47% this year over last year. And really quickly, I was wondering if you could kind of give us the latest on what the situation on the ground is with the Taliban and its offenses.
Well, this report by the United Nations has definitely established one fact, and that is that the Taliban's offensives that have captured so many districts over the last a few weeks have not been bloodless, because killing of nearly 1,600 people and overall 5,200 casualties is a lot in the last 6 months, because most of these casualties have occurred over the past 3 months, ever since the United States and allied forces started withdrawing from Afghanistan. So that is a very dangerous trend, and that's what the United Nations has warned, that if this trend continues, by the end of this year, Afghanistan may witness the highest number of civilian casualties in a single year, which is very unfortunate in a war that has already killed, according to several estimates, more than 250,000 people over the last 20 years.
From Islamabad, Pakistan, that was Ayaz Ghul. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Tunisian President Kais Saied has relieved the country's prime minister of his duties and suspended parliament amid applause from some quarters and protests from others. The move came after weeks of political turbulence in the country, fueled in part by public anger over the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporter Iman Bliwa joins us from Tunis. Iman, I wanted to ask you, what has been the reaction throughout the country, not only in Tunis, but throughout the country following the freezing of parliament by the president? Is it really doing anything to kind of quell the discontent that led to that decision?
People are so happy with this decision because for me, as a journalist, I've been asking people on the street and they were saying that the parliament are not doing anything and they are just not, parliament members are not aware of the people's problem and crisis, the economic crisis that they have gone through. The purchasing power are going down and the life conditions are getting harder for the regular Tunisian. So that's why they went to the street and they wanted the parliament to be gone since like at least after the revolution, the hopes were rise to for the system to be fixed. However, it was not the case, and they had to go through a lot of sacrifices that were not met with any results by the government. So the people are trying just to live today, just to have their daily living covered. However, that's not happening for them, and life is getting harder during the pandemic and because of the economic crisis. The reaction of the people, like minutes after Saeed was on TV saying that he suspended the parliament and have the prime minister suspended as well. So people went to the streets shouting his name, and fireworks were on the sky with the helicopter around just to control the situation. And people were happy with that decision because they think it's a way to stop the corruption, and it's a way to sort it out towards fixing the economic situation.
Iman, I wanted to ask you about the opposition, because they came out Sunday evening very strongly, calling the president's actions essentially a coup when he implemented Article 80 to freeze the parliament for a month. What has the opposition party done so far on Monday? I know they were trying to get into the building later that evening, but they were turned away, according to witnesses, by military personnel. But what have they done so far during the day?
The head of the parliament, along with the opposition and along with a lot of parliament members, tried to access the parliament building. However, they were faced with the military forces who denied their entrance. There was a conversation between them saying that this is their building, and the president of the parliament, Mr. Rasim Ghannouchi, said that he is the head of the parliament and he is authorized to enter. However, the military forces informed him that they have an order not to allow anyone to enter to the building, and they will not allow him to do so, along with a lot of parliament members. This was on early hours on this morning, today, on the 26th of July. From early morning, people, along with parliament members, were demonstrating in front of the parliament, objecting the decision to suspend the parliament activity and to close it in the face of its own members.
Iman Bliwa reports from the capital of Tunisia, Tunis. Myanmar's MRTV, which is a state-run television station, announced on Monday that the Union Election Commission, or UEC, has annulled the results of multi-party general elections held on November 8th due to misconduct of election rules and regulations. However, international observers and domestic observers said the 2020 elections in Myanmar were free and fair, apart from negligible discrepancies. To take a look at the broader implications of that decision, I spoke with Greg Poling, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
I guess this is an unsurprising doubling down of the rhetoric by the junta, which isn't going to convince anybody. But clearly, they're banking on this idea that they had first trotted out when they launched the coup back in February, that this was all because the National League for Democracy had somehow stolen the election. Nobody believed it then. And now that they're claiming they found 11 million cases of fraud in a country of 50 million people, of course, nobody's going to be convinced.
So what does this mean for democracy in the country? Because as you mentioned, you know, they were trying to make the case that there was fraud committed by the NLD. And back in May, you know, they dissolved the party. And, you know, going through the trial process right now is the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the president, Win Myint, and other leaders have been, you know, put up on charges. So what does this mean for democracy in a country that was already just experiencing a fledgling democracy?
It should be taken as further proof that the junta is not acting in good faith. Not that I think anybody thought they were. Their initial claim after the coup was that they were only taking power for 1 year under provisions of the Constitution and withholding elections. Since then, they've said, well, actually, maybe it'll be 2 years. Well, maybe it'll be whenever we get around to it. as you said, Aung San Suu Kyi is now on trial and likely to be imprisoned again on one of these five charges. And in all likelihood, they're going to disband and ban the National League for Democracy based on these trumped up charges. So it's gone from bad to worse.
So if we take a look at the country itself, since that February 1st coup, there have been ongoing protests, deadly at times, that really haven't, you know, abated in earnest since the coup. Given what happened with the election committee annulling the results, what impact do you think it's going to have on the protest movement in general, as well as the international community, who has repeatedly, you know, condemned the actions of the junta and their moves thus far?
I don't know that those engaging in the civil disobedience movement really care anymore what the junta authorities say. But it is going to be taken as further evidence that the regime has no interest in negotiating some kind of peaceful and equitable settlement here. They're really going for a scorched earth campaign against the NLD, against their international and domestic banks, the backers. And so it's only going to further this cycle towards state collapse, in which one side is basically an occupying power and the other side is trying to make the country ungovernable.
So do you see this as going back to a full military rule of the country? And you mentioned going forward to collapse. Does that mean that you see this as moving toward a state that can't sustain itself?
I think Myanmar is already a state that isn't being effectively governed at all. The military authorities running the junta are essentially a hostile occupying army in the cities and have loose control at best over the central countryside, significant chunks of the borderlands, even more than before the coup, are now in the hands of a mixture of ethnic armed organizations and these new People's Defense Forces being run nominally by the National Unity Government. And so what you're heading toward is increasingly a fractured series of microstates with a whole bunch of anarchy in the middle.
So what does that mean for the larger region in general? Because, you know, you take a look at ASEAN, which some people have really criticized for not coming out stronger against the junta. But what does it mean for the region at large?
It's really putting ASEAN in a tough spot, because ASEAN's position has been that it's not recognizing the junta, not explicitly, but it is de facto recognizing the junta because it sees it as necessary to work with. But as it becomes clear that the junta isn't actually governing the country in any sense of the word, it's more just a single side in a civil war, it's going to look more and more like ASEAN is, in fact, putting its thumb down on one side of the scale. It's also going to incentivize outside parties like the U.S. and the Europeans to more explicitly back the opposition National Unity Government, because, again, it'll look like this is not a case of an insurgency against a military government so much as two sides of a competing civil war, neither of whom have the real ability to govern the state. I think things are going to go from bad to worse. And the next 6 months is really going to be the decider on whether or not we head toward state collapse, the military's consolidation of the new totalitarian system, or perhaps the most unlikely outcome, the NUG and the ethnic arm organizations are actually able to force the military to the table.
You mentioned whether or not things are going to go from bad to worse. What are you looking at in terms of the situation in Myanmar and really the surrounding area that's going to be, in your mind, the deciding factor of what's going to mitigate things getting worse or what could conceivably turn things around?
So for the people of Myanmar, the biggest concern right now has to be the lack of access to medical and food aid amid this huge wave of Delta variant-driven COVID. And there's really no good answer from ASEAN or from the larger international community on how you get vaccines and medical equipment to a country that was already in economic and social freefall. For the military and the opposition, I think the real question is, can the NUG, the National Unity Government that's ruling pseudo in exile from Thailand, can they rally enough of the ethnic armed organizations to their side that it will force the military to the table? Because if they can't, then they have no hope of winning this thing.
That was the Center for Strategic and International Studies Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia, Greg Poling.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Russian space agency Roscosmos says that their docking module, Piers, was detached from the International Space Station at 10:55 UTC on Monday, July 26. The Piers module was used by Soyuz and Progress spacecraft to dock with the ISS since 2001. The module was attached to the Russian cargo spacecraft Progress 77, which acted as a kind of towing vehicle for the module. According to Roscosmos, once the two spacecraft were at a safe distance from the space station, they were put into a controlled deorbit and were expected to burn up in the atmosphere during re-entry, with any remaining debris landing in an unoccupied area of the Pacific Ocean. The space left by Piers will soon be taken by Russia's new multi-purpose laboratory module. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Moderna wants to expand its kids' vaccine study to better assess safety. Associated Press correspondent Shelley Adler has the details.
Moderna says it plans to expand the size of its COVID-19 vaccine study in younger children to better detect rare side effects like the type of heart inflammation recently flagged by U.S. health authorities. The company adds it's in talks with the FDA to enroll more study participants under age 12. While teens receive the same dose as adults, younger children may need smaller doses, so drug makers' research may take more time. Pfizer has the only U.S. vaccine authorized for children 12 years and up, while Moderna is expecting an FDA ruling on its application in the coming days. I'm Shelley Adler.
And finally, the number of known deaths from COVID-19 has surpassed 4 million. In the past 100 years, there have been flu and cholera epidemics, the AIDS epidemic, and multiple other diseases around the world. VOA's Carol Person says the latest research shows many epidemics either don't have to happen or can be contained.
As some countries prepare for yet another wave of the coronavirus, doctors in countries with a surplus of vaccines are begging people to get vaccinated.
I'm Dr. Michael Boulding. I've been working our COVID unit for the last 16 months. I get asked on a daily basis now what our COVID unit looks like.
Boulding says he is now seeing very sick, unvaccinated patients in their 20s and 30s.
With no comorbid conditions, ending up on ventilators, BiPAP, high flow oxygen, and extremely sick, sicker than at any time during this pandemic.
With a vaccine, severe illness and death from COVID-19 can be avoided. Amanda McClelland works to prevent epidemics at an organization called Resolve to Save Lives.
We're calling for a global goal of 717, 7 days to detect an outbreak, 1 day to notify an outbreak, and 7 days to mount an effective response.
VOA interviewed Amanda McClelland at a summit on disease prevention and control. She says it's possible to prevent epidemics and cites Uganda as an example. Uganda stopped a recent Ebola outbreak at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Uganda responded to the risk and mobilized their communities, mobilized their health systems to strengthen surveillance along the border, and was able to detect Ebola cases and care for those patients effectively, and they didn't have an Ebola outbreak.
In fact, a study released in April by Resolve to Save Lives that's called Epidemics That Didn't Happen included multiple examples of situations where countries avoided or stopped epidemics. Here's another example. In 2014, Nigeria stopped an Ebola outbreak, and in 2016, Brazil prevented a yellow fever epidemic from taking hold. In both cases, health officials implemented coordinated response activities, effective communication, and dedicated leadership. McClellan says the key is good leadership and building trust at the community level.
You can't just come when something bad happens. You have to be there all of the time. You have to meet the communities where they are and address their everyday health needs, and that builds trust.
McClelland says trust, good journalism, and a strong civil society help communities push back against disinformation and politicizing diseases, vaccines, and treatments. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.